usually when you rewatch something, you can be shocked. You once loved what you're viewing second time, or gain a new appreciation for it, or fall into a trance of nostalgia. It's rare that you reappraise something that you had no strong feelings for first go around and leave thinking that it's so good that you start wondering how it ever got on American TV. But I had such an experience with Mad Men. Mad Men is an atypical show for the TV land of the United States. It's not so much about gripping plots or completely outrageous characters that people relate to, as it is about vibes. It's about the vibes of having a whisper fight with your ex-wife while your sticky son is eating cereal two rooms over. The vibe of hearing a disgusting rumor about someone at your office, but being happy about the fact that you know it. And the vibe of waking up half drunk and your daughter calling you. Things happen in this show, and the characterization is excellent. But it's mostly about really greasy, awful guys being disgusting. Mad Men is amazing because it's about a politically fraught flashpoint in U.S. history, but not so much about politics. There are allusions and depictions of real events, but they're secondary to the character study we're watching. A guy may join a counterculture, or a woman may cry at the death of JFK, but it's all telling you what kind of office greaseball sad sack they are. This is a show about questions more central to the American experience than whether you're good or bad based on your side of history. It's about who gets to feel sorry for themselves in America, who gets the prize of group sympathy, who is born with the charisma that lets them escape the permanent judgment of their peers, and living in a hell you made for yourself. Let's get into it. Did you watch this when it was on?
I did, yes. This was the first one of that first wave of prestige shows that I got in on the ground floor on. This is one of the first one that I watched from the pilot while it was airing.
Yeah, I also watched from the pilot for two seasons, and it just like, it didn't really, I couldn't get it back then. I just didn't get it. I thought it was just like a boring show about guys who worked in the office and were like rude to their wives.
Yeah, it was it's a trip back in time to you're just imagining your grandpa when he could drink at lunch.
Yeah. How did you find it your first go around? Like, were you into it? Because I certainly wasn't. I didn't hate it, but I was just like, this is like kind of slow.
I was definitely into it in the first season, for the beginning. I actually got disenchanted with it over time. But my first encounter with it, I was like, wow, because it was the first show that I had approached with the point of view, having read stuff on the internet as a young person about how, ooh, TV, it's good now. And here's the best new, here's what it means to be a good show. And here's this guy who was on this other really good show, and now he's going to be making this show, and don't you want to see it? And I was like, hell yeah, fuck me up, fam. And I watched it, and with that in mind, sort of having been hypnotized into knowing what, like, expecting what I was going to get, which is like mid-century modernist fiction in dramatized form, which, you know, is the model that Prestige TV chose as its narrative, like, artistic structure. I was like, oh, okay, this is it. And it sort of taught me how to watch these shows as I was watching them. And so I was very much taken with it from the very beginning. After a while, I felt that it started spinning its wheels. But at no point was I ever really engaging the show at any level other than just basically, he's conflicted about his childhood. And also the 60s had different gender politics than they are now, something like that. Help me out.
Yeah, I guess that my one criticism of it going back through it, in an ideal world, like, again, the problem we have with all of these shows is that they're TV shows. Yeah. If this wasn't a TV show or it wasn't made in America, it could go on for 3 or 4 seasons, which would be, that would be perfect for it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
If this was 3 or 4 seasons, people would talk about it like it's, I don't think that people talk about it on the level of Sopranos and stuff. And I don't think it is, because yeah, 7 seasons is too fucking much. There's just not enough. No show has 7 seasons worth of shit. And especially not this show, because it's, yeah, like you said, like how many times can you show oh, like women were treated worse and like people were more openly racist. Like, how many storylines can you do about, oh, there's a big pitch? You can't do that much. But that's not really, I don't feel like that's an indictment on the show itself. It's just an indictment on TV.
Well, also, there's a limit. And specifically the fact that the protagonist is defined by his inability to grow or change.
Yeah.
Or break patterns, which means that he cannot be a vehicle for audience like growth the way that your a conventional narrative protagonist is. He just has to keep being pulled back down, and after a while that it just feels rudderless. And that's because it didn't have like a fully conceived outline from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, three seasons would have been, it's the perfect amount of like Don being like awful and self-pitying and hedonistic, and Roger being the same, and like Pete Campbell had a bit of some growth, but you know, etc. Everyone being disgusting, everyone being unhinged. Prestige TV is just the outgrowth of the novel. Like, the modern novel, people still write great novels, but the cultural space they occupy, or they used to occupy, is now taken up by Prestige. And this is, this is what I think is the first go around. I think I kind of took it like Revolutionary Road. It's like, I know this is very good, but I'm like 16. I don't really get this. But now, rewatching it now, I'm curious to how you found it rewatching it. I felt like it was like the trial. Like, this is something that's about like horrible things and confusing, awful situations, either of people's own creation or being foisted on them, but it's sort of a comedy.
Oh yeah.
I think I have a predilection towards taking things as a comedy, but it's a comedy. The trial is a comedy about like what an asshole he is. Like, what a fucking annoying prick he is despite this horrible thing happening to him. It is a comedy. And this is too. Like, I feel like I don't want to get too far ahead, because we're going to talk about characters after this, but I'm thinking about when Betty calls Don and they talk, like, after Don finds out she's dying, she has terminal cancer, and he just lies down, like, crying next to the phone, having what in, like, Grey's Anatomy or This Is Us would be, like, a huge character moment. And that woman just walks up and is like, are you waiting for a call? And he's like, what? Like, he's so awful. Like, they're all so fucking awful. And I felt like, I have a predilection to like interpret things as comedies when they're not always, but I feel like it's unmistakable.
Yeah, especially when you consider, spoiler alert, the way the series ends. I mean, it ends on a punchline, which is that kind of, it means there has to be an inherent comedy to the whole procedure.
Yeah. So how did you find it the second go around?
I appreciated it. I think I got too excited about it when it came out, because I was one of those people who was trying to fill the hole of books with this thing that's not as good. But then over time, I basically got disabused of it as it couldn't like fill the hole anymore. You know what I mean? Because over time, you know, this stuff, its impact lessens because it's not operating off of artistic, motives. It's operating off of capital motives. It's operating off of the fact that it's popular and people are watching it, and so they keep making more of them, and so that's going to make it over time, it's going to be even less able to sustain your interest. But now that I realized, oh, this is not really like what I was expecting from Mad Men the first time I watched it, isn't really something that I should expect from a television show, and that's not fair to expect it, and it's certainly not fair to blame the show. I now appreciate it again. I think it's good. I think it's definitely deserved its place as like one of the first and the first one to be off of HBO and not have the nudity violence crutch of HBO to operate with.
That is something. So the watching the actual show itself, that's what it was the thing that turned me off the first time, I guess. And the thing that I sort of like, so little happens.
Yeah.
Like, nothing happens in the episodes. It's like the biggest, it's sort of reminiscent of the way that Tree of Life is, where it's like not a lot happens in that movie ever, but it's more like it's a study in how you process memories, about how the memories of your childhood affect you. And there's a lot of that in this. And it actually, it captures the like shitty feeling, the shitty and good feelings of childhood in a way that Sopranos never would, because that's not what Sopranos was purposed for.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, in the way that Tree of Life captures like the way that you sort of remember things out of focus from your childhood, this captured how you remember like a bad day at the office, or like an eventful day, or like things that like, I watching the show, I had like a very distinct memory, and it was like of my dad, like trying to relate to me once. And he was like, yeah, I remember, because I'd had like a big fight with one of my friends when I was like 15. And he was like, yeah, you know, I something like that happened to me once. And, I had a car, and then there was one friend who was bigger than us, and me and him got into an argument, and I lost the fight. And then, 10 years later, I found out that he had killed himself. And it was like, what?
Jesus.
I was like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck? But it's like somewhat of a certain age. Anyone born like 1945 to 1960, all their stories they try to tell you have this like ambient like sadness,
yeah,
and loneliness, because it's like their meter for what's okay is so fucked up from growing up in that time.
Yeah.
And like, it, every story is like, David Sedaris writes about this, about how like everyone's dad knows like four guys who lost an eye, or like, oh, he got his, like in this show, got his foot run over by a fucking riding lawnmower because they were drinking. And that's why you like shouldn't do that when you drink. Everything is just like a random cruel event that's like you're just trying to fucking shoehorn a moral or a point in, but there is no point.
Yeah.
There's no point to any of this.
Like the ones, the moments that get that most concentratedly, because they are memories like within the context of the show itself, are Don Draper's childhood flashbacks to when he was Dick Whitman.
Yes. Like it's no. Yeah. Like every boomer, unless a boomer grew up like super rich, and maybe even if they did, all their story, like they're all so fucking weird and sad, all their childhood stories.
Yeah.
And you can't really grasp anything from them.
That's there's no moral or anything. It's just stuff that happened.
Exactly. But they need there to be a moral to relate to you, their kids. So it's like, oh yeah, the fucking girl who like a seagull flew into her eye and she got an infection, fucking died. That's why you should always be careful. I don't know. Like there's nothing. There's nothing. It's just like life is cruel. I don't really know if I'm remembering these things right. I don't even know if they happened to me or anyone I know. A Kafka-esque reflection of my own life. But, you know, here's some stuff that happened. Can you find some meaning for me?
Maybe? Yeah, yeah. Go shift through these bird pellets and tell me if there's anything in here.
Yeah. And that is, and maybe there is definitely not seven seasons worth of that, because as I watched this more, it did begin to drag, because it's like, oh, is Don going to do another weird sex thing? Or how many big presentations can you see?
Yeah.
Like the first couple times you see it, you're like, oh, that's a cool way to do a scene. And then the 20th time you're like, okay, I fucking get it. He's good at ads.
Yeah. Oh, is Peggy going to have overcome workplace discrimination again? But yeah. At what cost?
Is Joan treated awfully? Is Roger going to be gross? But the individual things I like Ken Cosgrove losing an eye. That's literally like a story my dad would tell.
Yeah.
Or like my grandfather. Yeah. Like what the fuck? Like, why did you tell me this? the guy from Lucky Strike being a fucking asshole. Like those are all like part of a tapestry of a weird collective boomer memory that I think is very real, where all the stories are sort of sordid and pointless. And the ambient feeling of every episode when you're fully into it is incredible. It reminds me of, Tree of Life, or even like Valhalla Rising, even the completely different thing, but where it's not about really what the characters are saying so much or the events, but it's like we have successfully created an atmosphere.
Yeah. Yes, it's vibe curation. It's
yeah.
what it felt like to live at the apogee of American prosperity. Like the thing that we were already sort of vaguely aware that we had gone beyond, and then to look back and to find that like even our memory of it, which is colored by that prosperity, was hiding the same blankness that is going to drive us to where we are and beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Just an endless sea of blankness. Like, I think about something I really like that the show does, and like, again, did not have to be seven seasons because I saw this device used a billion fucking times. But when a character has like an embarrassing or massive personal moment during like a stupid fucking ad presentation, like because that is such apogee of the Empire shit. Like Don, like missing Thanksgiving with his family to do the carousel presentation. That's like this dumb thing. The only thing he can relate to people interpersonally is by doing these stupid fucking presentations for the thing that's going to ruin American culture, advertising and marketing. And it makes Harry Crane cry and leave because he like fucked some girl in the office and cheated on his wife and has been sleeping on the couch. And it's like, you wanted to kill yourself and cried in front of the fucking Kodak guys.
One time I got shit-faced and I had to pitch a breakfast cereal after an award show.
Yeah, no, and that's like Harry Crane will tell that story to his kids or grandkids and like leave out some parts of it. Him and be like, I had a bad day and I drank, I drank gin after I drank whiskey and it made me have an episode. And that's why you shouldn't do that. Or Don, the reason Don has to like get the sobriety clause in his contract in the final season, when he tells his fucked up sordid life story to the Hershey executives because he got too drunk. Like, that's so darkly funny. Like, yeah, I grew up in a horrible, abusive, like, farmhouse during the Great Depression. And I stole some fucking guy's identity in the war to the candy executives, to the guys who inherited the candy company. But, that's about all I can say for, like, the actual production and show. Like, it looks great, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And if I'm looking for a reason why so many people watch this, why it was able to be sustained for seven seasons, I think that's it. I think, God damn it. Do you remember this in like 2014 when journalists would make like, they were like the first pick crews, like Mad Men art
ads? Oh God, that was the shit. That was like, it was to prove, you proved that you were a grown up by going from the South Park Avi to the Mad Men Abbey, yeah. And you're just there with like a highball and a little cigarette. Oh God, it's like the box, the little skinny tie.
Yeah, and I think that's why, because like this is a horribly depressing show, and there's like no redemption walking away from it. Like the point of it, as I interpreted the end, it's like you can have the first like actual personal moment of your life, and you just use it to sell the world's preeminent soft drink.
Yeah,
they didn't even need you.
Yeah,
but you made an ad that people liked, and the rest of your life is fucking hell. And I think that on its face is unattractive to people, but I think the look of it was so strong. And it's like you had all these leads. You had like John Slattery with his silver fox look, and John Hamm. Like everyone thought John Hamm was the hottest dude on the planet. And like there were those paparazzi photos where he wasn't wearing underwear. And
oh yeah, the like, giant
big
hog.
Soft cock. Yeah, it's like 9-inch cock. And like Christina Hendricks.
Oh yeah, Ahuka. Everyone's getting fucking, wildly horny to her for her.
All time fucking babe. So I think that and the look of the shit, like the actual art direction, everything was so strong. I think there are enough like simple people who are. Like, I just love the 60s. I think it's neat to watch that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, the same way as there were guys who loved to watch Sopranos because they loved to watch Tony own people.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that was that's the genre architecture that you have to have to get the eyeballs that in the absence of, you end up not getting an audience, because as much as you want to talk about how it's about the art, it's like it's a more populist medium than fiction is. And so it's going to have a more populist, like, genre infused hook, either in terms of content, like Sopranos, or aesthetics, that 60s jet age thing.
Yeah. And if you do something that's also of a genre, like swords and sandal genre, or cowboy, like Deadwood or Rome, it's actually so fucking expensive to do that on an episode by episode basis that it literally does not make economic sense.
Yeah, you can't even do it. Whereas here, it's like we can go to a bunch of swap meets and get enough Eames chairs and poodle skirts, and we can do this relatively cheaply.
Yeah. But the thing that I think is sort of the meat of the show is, like, there are some things that people try to, like people still try to relate to Peggy. People still think they're that.
You're a boss.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe if you're a woman or man on a breakdown, you're into Betty. Why not?
Yeah.
Great model for a breakdown.
Yeah, like month three of quarantine, it's like Betty. Goals.
Betty shooting the birds.
Yep.
Well, another awesome scene that's just like, a boomer story. Yeah, my mom went crazy.
Yeah, my mom went crazy and started shooting birds in our backyard.
Yeah, and that's why I'm anti-gun, I guess.
Yeah.
I really think it's about, as I experienced it, it's about how awful, like, all the Greatest Generation and Silent Generation men were and people were, and how insane they make their kids. The boomers.
Yes, of
That's
course.
That's how I
yes,
saw
because,
it.
Yeah, because of course, like, this movie is about, it's not about boomers. It's about the parents of boomers. So of course the real audience, the people who made it, they're not looking through the eyes of Don Draper or Betty or even Peggy. They're looking through the eyes of the kids at them and imagining what's in their brains. They're all, the girl, they're all his daughter.
The most explicit,
they're all what the fuck's her name?
Sally.
Sally. God damn it.
Sally Draper. The most explicit I felt like they were doing this was with, Sterling's storyline.
Yeah.
John Sterling's storyline, because it's like, he's a complete hedonistic asshole. Like, he tries to fuck Betty Draper while having a dinner party with Don.
Yeah. All class.
In his house. Yeah. Pure class, tears in my eyes. He divorces his wife, like, pigs out, like, all this shit. And his daughter, like, goes insane. His daughter goes insane because he did what all the Greatest Generation people did, even the rich ones. He is the rich one, which is, they're, like, just, he can only channel his emotions into, like, if you're rich, I guess hedonism.
Yeah.
Someone who's poor, they would just channel it into, like, fucked up stoicism or whatever.
Drink themselves to death.
Yeah. But he does whatever he wants, whenever he wants it. He portrays this, like, classical masculine image. You know, he'll go on a rant about the Japanese, like he does one episode, or, wear blackface to his own wedding. Yeah. But he does whatever he wants, whenever he wants it. And of course, like, he also gives his daughter everything she wants.
Yep.
He doesn't act as, like, a good parent, but any material desire or just cash or fucking whatever she wants, she gets it. And of course, when he leaves, she goes insane. It's like when have you ever heard these stories about, like, monkeys who are raised only by people?
Yeah.
They're fucked up.
Yeah.
They're fucked up. They have tons of monkey anxiety because all they can think to do, like, they never learned how to be a monkey.
Yeah.
Their only mode of survival is, like, being cute for a human.
Yeah, they never had their mom. I mean, they know their mom, and they couldn't find her.
Right. It fucks them up. You make a really fucked up, anxious monkey because you made him too dependent, but also removed the monkey from its family.
Yeah.
And that's what the boomers in this show are. The kids are.
Yeah.
Sterling's daughter, like, she ends up, like, just fucking off to, like, some stupid ass LSD farm.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, that's the boom. It's like, I'm rebelling against my hedonistic, willful, but also emotionally withholding parents by doing my own type of hedonism, my different type of hedonism.
Yeah, because the one thing you got from them was that there's nothing else but the self, and that there's nothing else but personal pleasure. Like you didn't, the way that they pursued it, you resented because it hurt you, but you fully absorbed because they and everyone around you were telling you, no, the only pursuit with any kind of any real reality, anything that's not, you know, made up is personal, however you define it. And the thing that made your parents bad is that they picked the wrong way to be indulgent, to be materialist.
Your parents who, like, you know, either they fought in the most lionized war in human history in World War II and the most destructive war, and they had that hard part of their life, and they came back, and then they just, like, you were the most important thing in the entire world to them, but their brains are incredibly fucked up from growing up in an even dumber time than you did. But they have the most money anyone has ever had.
Yes.
And God, they're going to make you so insane.
Yep. All they can do is show you affection through purchases.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I think though, like Don is, he is sort of the flashpoint of like the central joke. I think a lot of the joke of this show is like the stoic greatest or silent generation. Like Don Draper is literally the silent generation. He goes to Korea as a kid. He goes to one of the most fucking pointless, destructive wars that we've ever been a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And his entire quest is just to make women feel bad for him. That's his entire life.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is something I didn't fully realize about the character the first time I saw it. And I think it's funny that Don Draper, I mean, you know, the masculinity YouTube guys,
mm-hmm.
The Acclaimed Man or whatever.
Oh, right. Yeah.
All their videos are like, you know, how to have charisma like Don Draper. And it's like, well, A, you know, have John Hamm's face. B, have like a cock that's 9 inches soft that you can see through linen pants. But that's not the Don Draper has charisma, right?
Yeah.
But the charisma only function, he's like not a masculine or really like self-sufficient man in a lot of, like his entire thing is who is going to feel bad for me next.
Yep.
That's his entire life. His entire life is going place to place, like finding, because he's very rarely going to obliquely say it like, hey, I had this like fucked up story, my entire life is a lie. It just different little things all along the way, going up until that phone scene at the very in the final episode, and he just runs through so many fucking women, he runs through marriages, he runs through all this because he needs a woman to see a glimpse of him. The first time, every time, for the rest of his life, he's going to need to see a woman, see a glimpse of him brooding, not the whole thing. Only like, oh, he only tells one woman that he's with his entire like whole fucking life.
Mm-hmm.
But he just needs that initial glimpse of, yeah, a woman giving him validation for the first time.
Yeah.
And Roger, to his credit, doesn't have that. Roger just like, oh, what's the new type of sexy lady? A French one? Okay, fine. Whatever. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm going to die soon. Whatever. Who gives a fuck?
Maybe that's the difference between World War II and Korea. Like, you cashed in fighting the good war instead of stealing a guy's identity in the pointless, stupid war. So you got to have a lady always there to tell you that you're okay and that she loves you.
And I think, like, Don tries to. His kind acts by people are only like random things he does for women he's fucking or wants to fuck or wanted to fuck at some point. And they're always so like awful and stupid. Like the thing with Anna Draper, the widow of the guy he stole the identity from, with her daughter, like he gets drunk and tries to fuck her. And she's like, no.
Like, no. Oh, he's doing it again.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Hose him down.
But in the final episode where they're in the like hippie, like proto Marianne Williamson camp, and she has that, like she has a breakdown talking about her kid, and Don's like tracks her, like she storms out of the meeting, and Don like
flags are down. He's like, wait, listen, you just have to be successful and then people won't care. And she's like, get the fuck away from me. Like, he's disgusting. Like, he's a disgusting fucking person. And he lives in a hell that he creates.
Yeah.
And that's how I interpret the end. Like, I know Matthew Weiner said it's a happy ending because it's a great ad, but I don't know how ironic he was being or not, but I feel like that's his story.
Yeah.
That's just going to be his entire fucking life.
Yeah. And the only thing that is the only monument to it are the ads, which is, of course, like the real horror, because as good as they are, they're advertisements, which means they're literally evil.
Yeah. No, completely evil. And Don Draper's life is not even a life of like impressive evil. It's not like he was John D. Rockefeller or Carnegie building these horrible monuments to man's destructive power.
Or like Carlo Gambino or something.
Yeah, no, he just like made these like little movies about how the products are cool.
Money that they were all going to spend anyway. Products that basically sell themselves at the end of the day. Like those, we got Coca-Cola. It's like, they're not going to stop drinking Coca-Cola, you know? Like any ad would work at the end of the day. Like, it's just moving money around. It doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
And they have to know that the product is still around. And so it's just a way to move things through the system. And the only residue are just awful poison videos that are just injected into people's eyeballs.
But Don is so good at the poison videos that it, like, everyone validates it. Yeah. He's the most validated character in history.
Yeah, and that's why he is always miserable, because there's never any moment when he has to reckon with the calculus of anyone else's, like, desires. At the end of he is never confronted with the limitations to his ability to indulge himself. And that is like the story of these like protagonists from these early prestige shows. It's like the characters who just find no friction in their life, no matter what they try to do, and how that drives you crazy, because the hedonic treadmill burns out your CPU, because you can never have what you're seeking. So over time, all you feel is the absence of it, even though you're like having sex literally 10 times a day and just living the baller lifestyle. There is that need. There is seeking something more. And all you can imagine is getting these sexy ladies to tell me that they love me.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just the sexy ladies, but like the men, it's like, oh, I got to admit, Don's great at his job. Like, literally, in the second season, when the main thing that we are told to be afraid of in the narrative, like, Pete Campbell tells Don's bosses, his name is Dick Whitman, you know, he's a fraud, blah, blah, blah. And Cooper is like, who gives a shit?
Yeah, who cares?
Who fucking cares?
He's an earner. He brings in money.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, so there's, like, no real friction. There's no real friction except for Don's image versus Don's image of himself internally. But I think I really love that narratively. And again, like, it's kind of the only hallmark of this being an American show is that it's seven fucking goddamn seasons and that it's formulaic. But that central conceit, that's like a show they would watch in fucking Norway.
Yeah.
And it is amazing that this made it on.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but at the same time, you got to give a lot of credit to the fact that the terrain was as fertile as it was ever going to be for something challenging, because that was the moment when people were realizing, oh, great, we can watch TV instead of read books now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this was, because this really is, I mean, people said at the time, it feels like it's almost an attempt to adapt like John Cheever or something, you know, or like Updike, or I mean, there's a lot. If anyone has ever read Joseph Heller's follow up to Catch 22, Something Happened, which is it's not a technical sequel to Catch 22, but it's essentially the guys who fought in Catch 22 had to come home and get jobs. And it's about an ad executive who lives in Connecticut and cheats on his wife. And it's a stream of consciousness narrative of this guy's neuroses. and how miserable he is, even though he gets whatever he wants. And I believe that Wiener probably read that. And so it's staking a claim for a certain type of very recognizable, like, high modernist American art that everyone of, like, an educated bracket understands to be that way. And so they kind of get permission to be a little challenging, to be a little slow, to have a little less incident, and then they make it up for the fact that they're replicating the experience of those of that like type of narrative.
Yeah, yeah, and it did have the benefit of starting the year that The Sopranos ended.
Yeah, exactly. Because by the end of The Sopranos, everyone was like, "Wow, this is this was the show. This was as defining of the care of the." Of the content of prestige television as there was. Everything else was subsidiary and an offshoot or like an antithesis. And there needed to be something to fill the hole. And it was and the fact that Wiener had written on The Sopranos, it was almost amazing. And it still blows my mind that HBO passed on it. Just absolute idiots to not see that that is what people were going to be looking for is something else. And that it was going to have to be something a little more high toned in order to keep people, invested.
What's weird is the stuff that HBO ran after The Sopranos, it was stuff like Boardwalk Empire, which is like, I think a really good show. Not quite. I'd put it below Mad Men. I definitely put it below The Sopranos.
Yeah.
But Boardwalk Empire is like a fucking FX show.
Yes.
There's no like deeper understanding or anything. It's just like, hey, remember the 1920 election?
Well, they clearly, after The Sopranos, they clearly thought, oh, the mob, that's what people liked about it. And it's like, no, dude, that was why they started watching. But by the end of it, the response to it was not the good as it was the mob. It was all this other stuff. And so there were two roads. There was the genre trappings, which is Boardwalk Empire. And then there's the guts, which was Mad Men, and they decided to go with the genre trappings. And because the market had been created thanks to shows like The Sopranos, there was other money out there willing to take a bet on taking the other part of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, AMC really hedged their bets, though. Like, they also made an FX show, Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking Bad is also an FX show. Breaking Bad
is, like, the most high – it's the one that is, like – that rides the line.
Yeah.
But the fact that it was on AMC is one of the things that helped keep it on in most radars above the FX line. But yeah, certainly by the end, it was a full on FX show.
No, absolutely. Yeah. He was Vic Mackey at the end. I mean, that is, I guess that's sort of the meta within the meta. The market for these shows and how they're branded and how the shows brand the network, that's Don Draper's legacy.
Yep.
That's the science they figured out after 60s advertising was how branding works.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Boardwalk Empire, which is a fun but kind of a fucking stupid show, it had the benefit of the HBO branding, which also probably held it back because the people that would enjoy it the most probably never watched it.
Yeah, I remember when it came out, I watched the opening – the first episode, and you know, because it had the Scorsese imprature and everything, but
yeah,
I just at the time was like, and then I stuck with it for the first season, and it just by episode, it just felt like air coming out of a balloon.
Yeah, no, it was such a like dad show.
Yeah,
that's like a Ray Donovan type.
You know,
show.
It was an AMC dad show. The AMC dad show they followed up. Mad Men with Hell on Wheels.
Yes, yes, yes. No, that is always diversify your portfolio.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I guess getting to the end of it, what would you say like your biggest, because I think we're of two minds here. I think that I probably put this show, you know, Sopranos and Deadwood are like tier one or tier S or whatever. I put Mad Men like just a little bit below it. And I have a sense that you don't.
Well, I mean, if I think of the other shows that we've been talking about and other shows I've watched, even though I feel like I've kind of cut it down to size in my mind artistically over time, I think it's still definitely in the top, the upper half of those other shows. I definitely agree with that. And it still has moments that sit by themselves as great TV moments, like the lawnmower accident, which is still a wonderful filmed sketch. And there's some good episodes in there that stand out that I remember. And I do think that I really, really do, and this is always important with any kind of show, I really enjoy the ending. The last episode is great, and it has that infinite regressiveness that the end of The Sopranos had, that recognition that this is a cycle that can never end and that the hell is eternal.
It had individual things like Paul Kinsey, the prototypical DSA sexual harasser. But yeah, I mean, is it like the bloatedness that,
I think it's the sense that they took too long to set up his like terminal crisis because I guess that's like part and parcel with having the big punchline at the end where you see, oh, it's just literally being processed back into his machine for affirmation, is that it left them spinning the wheels a few times and I got kind of exhausted with Don as a character in a way that, even though I got why, it just wasn't adding, you know what I mean? So it wasn't additive. But I still think it's the best AMC show for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think the one thing, and yeah, I think one of the things keeping it below is like the bloatedness, the repetition, but I think one benefit afforded by the length of it, by seven fucking seasons, is it's one of the reasons why it was also good that The Sopranos was seven seasons, is getting to see the kids grow up.
Yeah.
I think it's cool because, yeah, you get to see the psychoses that these awful characters leave on their kids. And it also, it puts into play something else that I like about the show, that this is an infinite reflection, that this is an endless hell. And there's a false door that leads to a brick wall, and it's 60s counterculture.
Yep.
And I did like that a lot.
Yeah. The way that they handle the emergent 60s stuff is really good. And the way that they clearly intimate that, like, Sally, I could definitely see her joining the Weather Underground.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that it's not going to be anything other than just more narcissism and indulgence.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It just, you're like, yeah, your parents have a bunch of weird stories. Your dad, like, when he has dementia, tells you about him fucking some woman who owned a department store and then she died. Like, just, and you, like, you had like 5 years where you were, like building bombs that didn't work to blow up ROTC centers. And then the rest of the time, like, trying to figure out a way to get farmers to take LSD. And you marry some dumb fuck and you invest in Apple, and then you give your kids a whole different set of disorders.
Yeah, and the cycle continues. The circle of life continues.
So, final question, the thing we always end with. Do you think this could be made today?
The question I always got to answer, that ask yourself there is, like, standards have fallen in adult entertainment, as Jackie Treehorn said, but even though you might say that this could be a little above the brow now of the even lowered brow of like the main center of serialized entertainment on what is now basically streaming services, because everything's broadcast network is either it's a police officer or a police officer, a doctor or a lawyer in a city. That's the only thing they are. So it's all somewhere streaming or on cable, and there's just so many now.
Yeah.
There's so many motherfucking shows. There are shows that I find exist, that I find out exist, and then I find out have been on the air for like 4 years and that are already canceled. So
yeah,
I could see them getting at least a season, because with the pedigree of Matthew Weiner, I can't imagine them not giving him money.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much of this shit now.
There is, like, talk about something Liz Warren could do to make herself useful. Bring down the amount of shows. Have a hearing about the amount of fucking shows.
Yeah, let's purge shows. Too many shows.
Yeah. Axing the OA was probably a good start. I don't know if it was or not. I never saw it. But one less show, good. Let's make it 20 less.
Yeah. Just like stop green lighting things. You need to do two things. There's two things you can do here. One, fewer shows. Or if you must have shows, then you have to go buck wild. I'm sorry. You have to tell them, no, we're not looking for hour-long dramas about like a family's secrets or whatever the fuck. We've got enough of those. You got to come with this shit at an angle. Hell, why should it be an hour? Why or how about it's 46 minutes?
Yeah, no. Give it the cable TV drama length. Enough shows. Every show on Netflix, it's about like a town where everyone is psychic for 1 month out of the year. Or it's like a fucking scary village.
Yep, they love scary villages.
It's fucking dumb shit.
Scary village in the 80s.
How about a show where a dad is doing a science experiment and it turns him into the Bumblebee Man? And it's about him trying to reconcile that. And it's a drama. Like
it's fucking a drama.
It's a Bryan straight face whatever.
Drama. Yeah.
Whatever. Like, yeah.
Yes.
He's the Bumblebee Man. Like, yeah. His wife gets cancer and he's like, ay, caramba. But it's like, and it's like, can you stop doing that? And he's like, no, I can't.
I can't stop doing it. Dios mío.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A show about, like, I don't know. a show about, like, a group of guys trying to do 9/11 as an inside job, but they keep fucking it up. I don't know. I don't know, man.
Yeah,
like,
whatever.
Whatever. Just go crazy. Go crazy.
Hey, you know what there's never been a show about? I was thinking about this yesterday. There's never been a show about dentists. There's never been a TV show about dentists. There's never been a drama about dentists. They're also, because as much as every TV show is basically about people having different jobs, every scripted show is, every reality show largely is about people with different jobs. There are no, to my knowledge, reality shows about dentistry, even though they got a guy who like, yeah, I'm the dude who like saws giant bunions off your foot. He has a show. Nobody.
Two pawn shop shows.
There's Storage Wars, Texas, and Storage Wars, Quebec City, whatever the fuck. Real bog fuckers of Grungus County. There are no dentist shows because dentistry grosses people out and makes them uncomfortable. Well, then let's take a look. That sounds like art right there. It's something that gets everybody's brain itchy and makes them not want to look at it. Let's see what we could do with that genre. But if you're just going to, because you guys know it doesn't matter who watches this. Nobody watches any of these shows. You're just justifying your job and you're justifying you have to spend the money that these VCs are just pouring into your coffers on something. It doesn't have to be watched by anybody. So why the hell are you adhering to this fucking model that has been completely super saturated by 500 of your competitors? Let's see some dental programming.
Yeah, Netflix, every time they come out with a new show, like The Queen's Gambit, they're like, oh yeah, 300 million people watched this. Did they? Or have you just borrowed $200 billion fucking dollars if that's what you're telling your dumb money people?
Yep.
Because I don't believe you for a second.
No, they're all full of shit.
No, yeah. The dentist show, that would be a fucking... Okay, here's what I picture. It's like an FX show. And it's like sort of... You remember Jennifer Aniston and Horrible Bosses?
Oh, God, yeah. Horny dentist.
Yeah, it's about dentists who like fuck each other.
Hell yeah. Like Nip Tuck.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Nip Tuck, but dentists.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's mostly a comedy, but they're dramatic that like it's like, oh, this guy is like, this guy is like has a pill addiction and he's fucked up, but he has to like fix the worst molars in America or something.
Yeah.
That's, you know what? Fuck it. Do that.
Yeah. You got cameras in the back of the neck cameras to catch the whole inside of the mouth.
Yeah. Oh my God. Do a show about like a family that's been in the garbage business for three generations and it's not mob related.
Yeah. Yeah. Actual garbage people.
Yeah. Yeah. Do a show about like a guy who owns a rent-a-center, like a crooked rent-a-center owner.
Yeah.
I don't know. You fucking figure it out.
Figure it the fuck out.
Yeah. Go crazy. Go nuts. Yeah. Go stupid.
No more of these shows, though. If this is all you can come up with, then you've lost your show privileges, and you're going to have to cut them down like a good 50%.
Yeah. Stop it with the scary town. Stop it with like a, ooh, it's a high school, but they like fuck each other and do drugs. Shut up. Shut the fuck up. Yeah. You're fucking weird. You're a 52-year-old man who's never left Sherman Oaks, California. What the fuck are you talking about?
Dude, what if Casper the Friendly Ghost was like a horny teenager?
Yeah. No, that's what they're doing now. That's what they're doing. They're like, yeah. What if Ghost Rider wrote first person essays about trauma?
Yeah.
Who gives a fuck?
What if Richie Rich was in rehab?
Yeah. What if in Family Circus, like, I don't know, the mom like got death threats from the alt-right? I don't care. Yeah.
Lame.
Figure it out. Cut down the amount of shows. If you do another show like this, that's essentially a comedy about an awful guy who feels bad for himself all the time, I would love that.
I understand
that you won't do that.
Somebody who has has had only good things happen to them and therefore wants you to feel sorry for them.
Yes. As always, I'm Felix Biederman.
I'm Matt Crispin.
And we'll see you next time.
On the shows.
1, 2, 3, 4. Zooby zooby zoo, zooby zooby zoo, zooby zooby zoo, zooby zoo, zooby zoo. Mon Dieu, qu'ils sont doux. Zooby zooby zoo, zooby zooby zoo, zooby zooby zoo, zooby zoo, zooby zoo. Le bruit des